So we seem to be assembled again and can continue. We stopped at this interpolation about the creed, and now it goes on. You notice that Bloom is a little bit incautious. He could just be silent, but he always takes the other side and is kind of contradicting and all of that. That gets him, as we would see, a bit in trouble. Okay, now we read the next bit.
Of course, says Bloom, isn't discipline the same everywhere? I mean, wouldn't it be the same here if you put force against force? Didn't I tell you? As true as I'm drinking this porter, if he was at his last gasp, he'd try to downface you that dying was living. We'll put force against force, says the citizen. We have our greater Ireland beyond the sea. They were driven out of house and home on the Black 47, their mud cabins and their shieldings by the roadside were laid low by the battering ram, and the Times rubbed its hands and told the white-livered Saxons there would soon be as few Irish in Ireland as redskins in America. Even the Grand Turk sent us his piastres. But the Sassenach tried to starve the nation at home while the land was full of crops that the British hyenas bought and sold in Rio de Janeiro. Aye, they drove out the peasants in hordes. 20,000 of them died in the coffin ships. But those that came to the land of the free remember the land of bondage. And they will come again and with a vengeance. No cravens, the sons of Grania Whale, the champions of Kathleen Ni Houlihan.
Oh, Bloom. But, Bloom always, but, isn't discipline the same everywhere? I mean, Navy and Army, you need discipline. I mean, wouldn't it be the same here if you put force against force? Didn't I tell you, is the comment, as true as I'm drinking this porter, if he was at his last gasp, he tried to downface you that dying was living. Well, taking the other side. We'll put force against force as a citizen. We have our greater Ireland beyond the sea, meaning more Irish live in America than in Ireland. They were driven, the Irish, out of house and home in the Black 47, that is during the famine when the potato crop failed. Their mud cabins, simple, and their ceilings, they were little houses, by the roadside were laid low by the battering ram. And the Times rubbed its hands and told the white-livered Saxons, in cowardly, there would soon be as few Irish in Ireland as redskins in America. And there were views to that extent. And in fact, the Irish are often compared to the Native Americans or the blacks in America. Even the Grand Turk sent us his piastres. It seems Turkey did something to relieve the situation, but the British on the whole, which isn't quite true, of course, did very little. But the Sassenach, Saxon, tried to starve the nation at home while the land was full of crops that the British hyenas bought and sold in Rio de Janeiro. So there's always some truth in what he says, but not entirely. They drove out the peasants in hordes. 20,000 of them died on the coffin ships. The ships that took them to the America were often poorly equipped and many, many died. Whether it was 20,000, we don't know. But those that came to the land of the free, that's America, the Star-Spangled Banner, remember the land of bondage. Remember how it was bondage in the Bible. The Jews were in Egyptian and Babylonian captivity, the bondage that came on earlier. And they will come again and with a vengeance. No cravens, the sons of Granwale. Granwale is a legendary Irish female pirate. The champions of Kathleen Ni Houlihan. Kathleen Ni Houlihan was the H's impersonation in play of Ireland, Kathleen Ni Houlihan. It was a play that had led to a scandal. So we realized the citizen is saying things that he must have said often before. Good.
Perfectly true, says Bloom. But my point was, we're a long time waiting for that day, citizen, says Ned. Since the poor old woman told us that the French were on the sea and landed at Killala. Aye, says John Moyes. We fought for the Royal Stuarts that reneged us against the Williamites and they betrayed us. Remember Limerick and the broken treaty stone? We gave our best blood to France and Spain, the Wild Geese, Fontenoy, eh? And Sarsfield and O'Donnell, Duke of Tetuan in Spain, and Ulysses Brown of Camus that was field marshal to Maria Theresa. But what did we ever get for it? The French, says the citizen, set of dancing masters. Do you know what it is? They were never worth a roasted fart to Ireland. And they're trying to make an entente cordiale now at Chapey's dinner party with perfidious Albion. Four brands of Europe, and they always were. Conspire les Français, says Lenehan, nubbling his beer. And as for the Prussians and the Hanoverians, says Joe, haven't we had enough of those sausage-eating bastards on the throne, from George the Elector down to the German lad and the flatulent old bitch that's dead? Jesus, I had to laugh the way he came out with that, about the old one with the winkers on her, blind drunk in her royal palace every night of God, old Vic with a jorum of Mountain Dew and a coachman carting her up body and bones to roll into bed, and she pulling him by the whiskers and singing them old bits of songs about erring on the Rhine and come where the booze is cheaper.
Again, Bloom tries to argue. Perfectly true. But my point was, we are a long time waiting for that day, citizen. So somebody else contradicts the citizen, and he's listened to Bloom. Whatever Bloom says is sort of neglected. We are a long time waiting for that day when the Irish come out, citizen says. Since the poor old woman, that is Sean van Vocht, it's a personification of Ireland, the poor old woman, as in a song, told us that the French were on the sea at land. And the Irish, being too weak against mighty England, of course, always wait for an opportunity when England was engaged with France, a mighty power. And the French once were on the sea and landed at Calais. They didn't help much, and they lost, so there wasn't enough Irish support. So all these attempts to break free and fight Britain, they failed. Aye, said John Wise, we fought for the Royal Stuarts that reneged against the Williamites. That is the famous Battle of the Boyne, where the Stuarts, Catholics, were losing against the Protestants under William the Third when they betrayed us. And remember, there's a statue of King William, King Billy, in Dame Street. That was often the attack of nationalists. Remember Limerick and the broken treaty stone. There was some things in there. We gave our best blood to France and Spain, the wild geese. We've heard of the wild geese. They were Irish Catholic emigrants who went to other cities like France and Spain and Austria, Catholic countries, and often had high positions, the wild geese. Fontenoy, that's a battle of the English against the French, and some Irish troops fought with the French. And Sarsfield and O'Donnell, Duke of Tetuan in Spain. So these were a lot of Irish aristocratic emigrants in Spain. And Ulysses Brown of Camus, that was field marshal to Maria Theresa. There was somebody like that, though it is not quite accurate. But here you have finally a Ulysses in the book. That's called, but that's merely the name of some Irish aristocrat. But that, what did we ever get for it? And the citizen, who not only hates the English, but also everybody else. The French, says the citizen, set of dancing masters. Do you know what it is? They were never worth a roasted fart to Ireland. I don't know the value of roasted farts, but aren't they trying to make an entente cordiale now at Tepe's dinner party? So the English and the French made an agreement, ordre cordial, before the World War, at Taipei's. T.P. O'Connor was a famous journalist and owner of newspapers. Dinner party with perfidious Albion, you know that phrase, perfidious Albion. Firebrands of Europe, there always were. And then Lenehan, who knows about the French, Corse bien les Français, says Lenehan, nobbling his beer. And as for the Prussians and Hanoverians, because there was a German line in the British royalty, as you know, said Joe, hadn't we had enough of those sausage-eating bastards? The Germans were always called the sausage-eating bastards. On the throne, from George the Elector down to the German lad. The German lad, who is that now? That's Albert. Oh, yeah, that's Prince Albert, of course, who was married to Victoria. That, and that's Queen Victoria, remember. By the way, imagine Joyce had tried to publish this book in England with a reference to the flatulent old bitch that's dead, Queen Victoria. That would Jesus, I had to laugh at the way we came out with that, about the old one with the winkers on her blind drunk in the royal palace. There was always a rumour that she was drinking. Every night of God, old Vic, Victoria, with a Joram of Mountain Dew, that is a bit of whiskey, and her coachman carting her up body and bones to roll into bed. There was always the rumour that she had an affair with some of the domestics there. Rolling in bed, and she pulling him by the whiskers and singing him old butcher songs about Erin on the Rhine and come where the booze is cheaper. That's a great one. Imagine Victoria singing Come Where the Booze is Cheaper, which was, of course, a musical song. But we know the story behind it. It seems at one time there was a German band playing outside the castle, and she liked the melody, and that was musical, Come Where the Booze is Cheaper, and she wondered what the melody was, and they had probably a tough time explaining to Her Majesty just what the implication was. But Queen Victoria singing, Come Where the Booze is Cheaper, that's just great. Yeah. Good.
Well, says JJ, we have Edward the Peacemaker now. Tell that you were fooled, says the citizen. There's a bloody sight more pox than pax about that bio, Edward Guelph Whetton. And what do you think, says Joe, of the holy boys, the priests and bishops of Ireland, doing up his room in minute in his satanic majesty racing colours and sticking up pictures of all the horses his jockeys rode? The Earl of Dublin, no less. They ought to have stuck up all the women he rode himself, says little Alf. And says JJ, considerations of space influenced their lordship's decision. Will you try another, citizen, says Joe. Yes, sir, says he, I will. You, says Joe. Beholden to you, Joe, says I. May your shadow never grow less. Repeat that dose, says Joe.
Well, says JJ, we have Edward, King Edward, the peacemaker, as they say they tried to have an autort. Tell that to a fool, says the citizen. There's a bloody sight more pox that syphilis than pax, peace, than about that boyo, Edward Guelph Whetton. Now, we know the Prince of Wales, the Guelph Whetton, German crown, was a womanizer. And what do you think, said Joe, of the holy boys, the priests and bishops of Ireland, doing up his room in Maynooth in his satanic imagination colours, and sticking up pictures of all the horses in the jockeys road, the Earl of Dublin, no less. So there was always a strange relationship when English royalty visited Dublin. they had to accept them, but of course there was opposition. And it seems that on one of the visits, either as king or the Prince of Wales, he was invited to Maynooth. Maynooth is the Irish priest seminary. That's where Catholicism is dispersed. And they put him up in his racing colours, because he was horse racing, of course, and sticking a picture of all the horses of his jockeys rode. The Earl of Dublin, they made him, gave him the title, the Earl of Dublin. And so as that. The otter have stuck up all the women he rode himself, said Little Alf. And says J.J., considerations of space influence their lordship's decision. Will you try another? Says Joe. Says another round of drinks. Yes, sir, says he, I will. You, said Joe. Behold to you, said Joe, may your shadow never grow less. Repeat that dose. And so there's another round of drinks among the few then. And now we come to a first climax in the
Bloom was talking and talking to John Boyce, and he quite excited, with his dun duckety mud coloured mug on him and his old plum eyes rolling about. Persecution, says he, all the history of the world is full of it, perpetuating national hatred among nations. But you know what a nation means, said John Boyce. Yes, says Bloom. What is it, says John Boyce? A nation, says Bloom. A nation is the same people living in the same place. Be God then, says Ned, laughing, if that's so, I'm a nation, for I'm living in the same place for the past 5 years. So, of course, everyone had a laugh at Bloom, and says he, trying to muck out of it, or also living in different places. That covers my case, says Joe. What is your nation, if I may ask, says the citizen. Ireland, says Bloom. I was born here, Ireland. The citizen said nothing, only cleared the spit out of his gullet, and gob, he spat a red bank oyster out of him, right in the corner. After you with the push, Joe, says he, taking out his handkerchief to swab himself dry. Here you are, citizen, says Joe. Take that in your right hand and repeat after me the following words.
So now Bloom comes out. It is probably that not everybody in the pub here's everybody else. Anyway, Bloom was talking and talking with John Wise, and he quite excited with his dun-duckety mud-coloured mug on him. A mug is a face. Obviously, dun-duckety mud-coloured is not a compliment. Mug on him. And his old plum eyes rolling about. Persecution, says he. All the history of the world is full of it. Perpetuating national hatred among the nations. And here Bloom, among nationalists, is in a way saying almost the obvious. You also see that very little has changed in the world. That's one reason why this book is also so topical as well. But among nations. But do you know what the nation means, says John Wise? Yes, says Bloom. I think he said it a bit reluctant. What is it? Now imagine for a moment you have to define what the nation is. That's a job that many have had. What is a nation? What is Switzerland? Things like that. And you realize you would get into trouble. Never to be. But a nation, says Bloom, a nation is the same people living in the same place. That's a very liberal way of thinking. A nation is the same people living in the same place. It's not a very accurate or good definition, of course, but it's something like that. And you see, immediately, God, by God, says Ned laughing, for that's so, I'm a nation. Well, I'm living in the same place for the past 5 years. You see, any attempt at a definition you can always take up, and it's nonsense. And he says, well, I have been living in the same place, so I'm a nation. So obviously, Bloom is not the what is it, a philosophical person who can give a definition of the cup. So I'm living in the same, by the way, you see, I'm living in the same place. That is Anglo-Irish. In England, you would have to say, I have been living in the same part of this. So, of course, everyone has a laugh at Bloom and says, he, trying to muck out of it. So his first attempt wasn't so good, and then he corrected. Or also living in different places. It's partly an answer, of course, for his own person. I have been living in the same place, but in a nation of people, they may be different. So from his point of view, he's quite right. That covers my case, says Joe. And that's another joke. For he obviously says, and that was quite true, it was often easier to move house than to pay the rent for the old one. And so again, Bloom's attempt is ridiculized. That covers my case. But then, Sitton, what is your nation, if I may ask, said the citizen? Ireland, says Bloom. I was born here, Ireland. And here, Joyce, calls up the, how do you define a nation? And you know, they're quite different attitudes. If you're born in the States, you become American automatically. But other countries like Switzerland, it depends on blood relationship, and it can be very, very strange. And every nation has different rules. And so here, that thing, it's an important issue, of course. That also comes here. But don't remember in the when George's wrote that during the war, but how the question of what is a nation, who is German, who is Czech, and all of this became a very, very serious issue. Ireland, I was born here. The citizen said nothing, and only cleared the spit of his gullet, and gob he spat the red bank oyster out of him right in the corner. So instead of saying something, you can also spit. That is not a very polite way, but you see how Bloom is treated, things like that. A red bank oyster, oysters were famous from the red bank in the west of Ireland. And just a small thing, there was a Red Bank restaurant with oysters, and Bloom had seen boiling outside of that in the morning. That comes up later. Off you with a push, says Joe, says he, taking out his handkerchief and swabbing so dry. And now he takes the handkerchief and cleans his mouth. There you are, citizen, says Joe. Take that in your right hand and read on me the following word. So the drinks are coming, and you have to say something. And now we have another interlude that describes that handkerchief. Remember, very early in the book, in the first chapter, Morrigan took Stephen's dirty handkerchief. Don't forget, in those days, we had cloth handkerchiefs, not paper, to throw away, and they were usually not very, very clean. And now here we have the description of a dirty handkerchief, as though it were one of these arts of Irish Celts, all these wonderful things they had, that of course had just been revived and re-evaluated. So another interpolation.
The much treasured and intricately embroidered ancient Irish face cloth, attributed to Solomon of Droma and Manus Tomalacht Og MacDonagh, authors of the Book of Ballymote, was then carefully produced and called forth prolonged admiration. No need to dwell on the legendary beauty of the corner pieces, the acme of art, wherein one can distinctly discern each of the four evangelists in turn, presenting to each of the four masters his evangelical symbol, a bog oak scepter, a North American puma, a far nobler king of beasts than the British article, be it said in passing, a Kerry calf, and a golden eagle from Carrantuil. The scenes depicted on the Avantri field, showing our ancient dunes and raths and cromlechs and grianons and seats of learning and maledictive stones, are as wonderfully beautiful and the pigments as delicate as when the Sligo illuminators gave free rein to their artistic fantasy long, long ago in the time of the Barmecide days. Glendalough, the lovely lakes of Killarney, the ruins of Clonmacnoise, Cong Abbey, Glenannor and the Twelve Pins, Island's Eye, the green hills of Talla, Croagh-Patrick, the brewery of Messrs. Arthur Guinness, Son & Company Limited, Loch Ness Banks, the Vale of Avoca, Isolde's Tower, the Mappus Obelisk, Sir Patrick Down's Hospital, Cape Clear, the Glen of Aherlow, Lynch's Castle, the Scotch House, Rathdown Union Workhouse at Loughlinstown, Tullamore Jail, Castle Connell Rapids, Kilbally MacShonachill, the Cross at Monaster Boyce, Jury's Hotel, St. Patrick's Purgatory, the Salmon Leap, Maynooth College Refectory, Curley's Hole, the three birthplaces of the first Duke of Wellington, the Rock of Cashel, the Bog of Allen, the Henry Street Warehouse, Fingal's Cave, all these moving scenes are still there for us today, rendered more beautiful still by the waters of sorrow which have passed over them and by the rich incrustations of time. Sure bazaar with the drinks, says I. Which is which? That's mine, says Joe, as the devil said to the dead policeman.
Not this top here, yeah. So now a description in the style of the time of Irish antiquity. The much treasured and intricately embroidered ancient Irish face cloth attributed to Solomon of Drogheda MacDonagh, author of the Book of Ballymote, that is a real one of these artistic productions, and they're possible authors, was then carefully produced and called forth prolonged admiration. Now, don't forget, who wants to look at the dirty handkerchief that the citizen has just wiped his mouth with? No need to dwell on the legendary beauty of the corner pieces, the acme of art, wherein one can distinctly discern each of the four evangelists in turn presenting to each of the four masters his emblematic symbol. There is an annal of the four masters, an Irish history thing like that. And of course you have the corner pieces of the four evangelists. And you know the evangelists are represented by a lion, by a calf, and I forget, between the Book of Kells. But here you have a bog oak scepter, a North American puma, far nobler than the King of Beasts and the British article began passing, because I think Luke is presented as a lion, and of course the lion is also British, a Kerry calf, and a golden eagle. There's one of them is an eagle from Caranto Hill. Remember the handkerchief that Buck Mulligan took out of Stephen's closet and held it up on show. Very humiliating. And that is probably not a much more attractive handkerchief. The scene depicted on the emunctory field. Emunctory is clearly Latin for what you do with a handkerchief, you sneeze into it, or things like that. Showing our ancient duns and rasts and cromlechs and grianons, these are all early stone construction, and seats of learning and maledictive stones. They had stones that were maledictive, that could curse you, and you realize maledictive suits this chapter very well, because the main story is rather maledictive, having something nasty to say about everybody, are as wonderfully beautiful and the pigments as delicate as when our Sligo illuminators gave free rein to their artistic fantasy long, long ago in the time of the Barmecides. And now there's illustrations. Whenever we come together in the foundation, we have somebody sent us a picture. These are all postcard places, you know, sort of like Matterhorn and that kind of stuff. Glendalough, that where a saint was, the lovely lakes of Killarney. They're, of course, famous tourist spots. The ruins of Clonmacnoise, Cong Abbey, Glenanna, and the Twelve Pins, Ireland's Eye, the Green Hills of Tallaght, Croagh Patrick, the brewery of Messrs. Arthur Guinness and Company. That's a bit different, but the brewery was a site, and the tourists could be shown around it. And I remember when I was there and got the whole tour. Now you get the film, by the way. But it is worth seeing. But you realize it's not quite the same thing. Church buildings of old and breweries, not earlier. Arthur Guinness and Company, Limited, Loch Nee Banks, the Vale of Avoca, has been sung by Thomas Moore, Isolde's Tower and the Muppet's Obelisk, St. Patrick Down's Hospital, I don't know about that one, Cape Clear, the Glen of Atherlow, Lynch's Castle, that is in Galway, the Scotch House, that is an ordinary pub, nothing particular, in fact. Simon Dedalus was there early in the day. The Rathdown Union Workhouse at Lochringstown. That is unlikely to be a very attractive building. That looks like the Tullamore Jail. Also, Castleconnell Rapids. Kilbally MacConnachill. The Cross at Morris the Boyce. Jury's Hotel. Jury's Hotel was in Dame Street. And it was the first building knocked down in an old street. Something that couldn't happen in Zurich. And Jury's Hotel was demolished. And Jury's Bar can now be seen at Pelikanstrasse, 5 minutes from the foundation. That is now the Joyce Pub. And if there hadn't been that Joyce Pub, there wouldn't be a Joyce Foundation. So, St. Patrick's Purgatory, the Salmon Leap, Maynooth College Refectory. Maynooth is a seminar for priests. Curly's Hole, I don't know. The three birthplaces of the first Duke of Wellington. I don't quite know where the Duke of Wellington was born, but when they said to Wellington that he was an Irishman, because he was born in Dublin, he said, because you're born in a stable doesn't make you a horse. So he was not somebody who was proud of being Irish. The Rock of Castle, the Bog of Allen, the Henry Street Warehouse, that must be a deposit, Fingal's Cave, all these moving scenes are still there for us today, rendered more beautiful still by the waters of sorrow which have passed over them, like somebody wiping his mouth, and by the rich incrustations of time, the handkerchief. So you see here that the handkerchief that in the first chapter was a quick thing is now coming to its full glory is compared to an Irish. You can imagine that not all Irish readers were too happy about the way how Joyce treated almost everything. Okay, back to the pub.
And I belong to a race too, says Bloom, that is hated and persecuted. Also now, this very moment, this very instant. God, he near burnt his fingers with the butt of his old cigar. Robbed, says he, plundered, insulted, persecuted, taking what belongs to us by right. At this very moment, says he, putting up his fist. Sold by auction, off in Morocco, like slaves or cattle. You're talking about the New Jerusalem, says the citizen. I'm talking about injustice, says Bloom. Right, says John Moyes. Stand up to it then with force like men. That's an almanac picture for you. Mark for a soft-nosed bullet. Old lardy face standing up to the business end of a gun. Gob, he'd adorn a sweeping brush, so he would, if only he had a nurse's apron on him. And then he collapses all of a sudden, twisting around all the opposite, as limp as a wet rag. But it's no use, says he. Force, hatred, history, all that. That's not life for men and women, insult and hatred. And everybody knows that it's the very opposite of that that is really life. What? Says Al. Love, says Bloom. I mean the opposite of hatred. I must go now, Zita John Wise. Just around to the court a moment to see if Martin is there. If he comes, just say I'll be back in a second. Just a moment. Who sinned, didn't you? And off he pops like grease lightning. A new apostle to the Gentiles, says the citizen. Universal love. Well, says John Wise, isn't that what we're told? Love your neighbours. That chap, says the citizen. Beggar my neighbour is his motto. Love my ya. He's a nice pattern of a Romeo and Juliet. Love loves to love love.
My office talks here.
Loves the new chemist. Constable 14A loves Mary Kelly. Gertie McDowell loves the boy that has the bicycle. MB loves a fair gentleman. Li Chi Han, lovey up kissy, chap poo chow. Jumbo the elephant loves Alice the elephant. Old Mr. Vershoyle with the ear trumpet loves old Mrs. Vershoyle with the turned in eye. The man in the brown Macintosh loves a lady who is dead. His Majesty the King loves Her Majesty the Queen. Mrs. Norman W. Tupper loves Officer Taylor. You love a certain person, and this person loves that other person because everybody loves somebody, but God loves everybody.
Yeah, that's an early climax of the chapter here. Sandy Bloom comes out again and says, and I belong to a race too, says Bloom. That is hated and persecuted. Here we have the Jewish side of it, clearly. Also now, this very moment, this very instant. Now, I believe that, as I said before, Bloom is a bit unwise, not very clever. It's better to keep out of that. But this very moment, I suppose he's also worried about what happens at home this very moment. So his anger that comes out is also a bit displaced. Should really be directed to home. But there were things going on. Gob, he near burnt his fingers with the butt of his own cigar. You see, Bloom is not a clever speaker. Anyone with a cigar would do wonderful things, but Bloom doesn't quite succeed in the gesture. Robbed, says he, plundered, insulted, persecuted, taking what belongs to us by right. At this very moment, says he, putting out his fist, sold by auctions off in Morocco, like live or cattle. I don't know what happened at this particular time in Morocco. There must have been something. But we know that in 1903, a few months ago, there had been a very ugly case of anti-Semitism in the country. There was some. Now, there weren't many Jews in Ireland. There weren't any kind of a threat or anything. But, of course, there was anti-Semitism. And you can see here that Joyce, in his novel of 1904, put the finger on something that was to develop in a way that nobody could have anticipated. It was there. And it shows that Joyce really was aware of certain things. And I always say it would be a happier world if now somebody had to explain to people, 100 years ago, they had all these prejudices. But you realize, if anything, it's getting worse. So robbed, so like the color. And then see, are you talking about the New Jerusalem? One, a kind of Zionist, says the citizen. I'm talking about injustice, says Bloom. Right, that's all right. Stand up to it then, you force like men. They're glad that there's some kind of conflict to entertain them. There's an almanac picture for you. Mark for a soft-nosed bullet. Old lardy face, standing up to the business end of a gun, in a way. Bloom, facing artillery, lardy face, soft-nosed bullets, by the way, was something relatively new. There were bullets that were, not pointed, dum-dum, you know, that turned in the body and made much more rhino. So that was something from the Boer War, soft-nosed bullet. And Gob, he'd adorn a sweeping brush. He's not a male fighter. He's rather feminine, as we said. Sweeping brush. So he would, if he'd only had a nurse's apron on him. And then he collapses all of a sudden, twisting round all the others, limp as a wet rag. And then he room feels he's not a great speaker, a great orator. And that's in a country where speaking well is a great virtue. And the Irish have always been good at that. They always have great speakers, but Bloom is not. And so he... And it's no use, says he, force, hatred, history, all that. That's not life for men and women, insult and hatred. And everybody knows it's the very opposite of that that is really life. What, says Alf? And here Bloom, and I believe Bloom is cornered a bit. I don't think he shouts this out like an evangelist. Love, Bloom says. I mean the opposite of hatred. Would be better if we loved each other than if we hated each other. Nothing. But then, I must go now, says the John Royce. Just round the court a moment to see if Morty is there. If he comes, just say I'll be back in 6 minutes. So Bloom realises he's not a great rhetorical success and he wants to leave for a moment as he feels clearly uncomfortable as well as unwelcome. Who's hindering you? And off he pops like greased lightning. Even that, we have that in Germany, greased lightning. So he leaves. A new apostle to the Gentiles, says a citizen, universal love. And of course, here you see the irony. Sandy Bloom, the Jew, proclaims that love, which is after all the message of Christianity. And don't forget the Christians said, some still do, that it was the Jews who betrayed and killed Jesus Christ. And now Bloom is the one who speaks what basically a good Catholic should say. Well, says John Wise, isn't that what we're told? Love your neighbours. So Bloom comes out, ironically, like a traditional Catholic Christian. That chap, says the citizen, beggar my neighbour is his motto. Love, moya. Moya, I don't know if it's still used, is a word that undoes everything. Oh, there's nothing to it in Spiegel or something like that. He's a nice pattern of a Romeo and Juliet. And you see how the citizen changes the topic. Bloom wasn't talking about erotic love. He was talking about Christian, what the Christian would call agape, the kind of thing. But here it's taken at face value. Love, he's a nice pattern of a Romeo and Juliet. Again, fittingly, a play which combines a love plot with death, things like that. And then you get another interpolation that, in a way, pulls the rug over. You see, Joyce could have been very romantic and sentimental, but it's undercut by ridicule and all of that. And then you have love, lust, love, love. And then you get the list. Nurse loves the new chemist. Constable 14A loves Mary Kelly, a policeman and a domestic servant. Gertie McDowell loves the boy that has the bicycle. We heard about Gertie McDowell before, but you've probably forgotten it. M.B. loves a fair gentleman. M.B. could be Marion Molly Bloom, and the fair gentleman could be a visitor. Then, Lichy Han, love the up, kissy, cha cha chow. In other words, they also do it in China. Jumbo, the elephant, loves Alice, the elephant. And that was a big story. As far as I know, they had Jumbo and Alice, two elephants, in the London Zoo. And one of them, I think, Jumbo, was sold to Barnum. And you know how the English love animals, and there was a big outcry in the newspapers and all of this. So the kind of loving elephant couple was separated. Old Mrs. Wurzkoil with the ear trumpet loves old Mrs. Wurzkoil with a turned in eye. So an old couple. Once you're old yourself, this is not all that funny. The man in the brown Macintosh loves a lady who is dead. Remember the man in the Macintosh at the funeral? Who knows? His Majesty the King loves Her Majesty the Queen. Mrs. Norman W. Topper loves Officer Taylor. Remember, that is in the Police Gazette, when they saw an adultery case where Norman Topper's wife had an affair. You love a certain person, and this person loves that other person, because everybody loves somebody, but God loves everybody. So the whole thing, in a way, collapses in a sort of parody. But I think we all feel it's an important page, where, in a way, that could have been built up quite much more dramatically and all of it. But Joyce doesn't allow us to get very romantic about the whole thing. So, but Bloom speaks up, in a way he speaks up against kind of hatred. Good. Back to the bar.
Well, Joe, says I, you're very good health and song. More power, citizen. Hurrah there, says Joe. The blessing of God and Mary and Patrick on you, says the citizen. And he ups with his point to wet his whistle. We know those canters, says he, preaching and picking your pockets. What about sanctimonious Cromwell and his Ironsides that put the women and children and throttled into the sword with the Bible text, God is love, pasted round the mouth of his cannon? The Bible? Did you read that skit in the United Irishman today about that Zulu chief that's visiting England? What's that? Says Joe. So the citizen takes up one of his paraphernalia papers and he starts reading out.
Okay. Well, said Joe, said I, a very good health and some more power, citizen. Well, the drinks are coming. Hmm? The blessing of God and Mary and Patrick on you, said the citizen. You see, these blessings don't mean very much anymore. Hmm? And he ups with his pint to wet his whistle. Drink. We know those cantos. Cant is from cantare, singing. Cant is when you're not serious, when you pretend, cantos. So see, preaching and picking your pocket. What about sanctimonious Cromwell and his Ironsides? Cromwell came to Ireland and he devastated it. He's a bad name in Ireland. Sanctimonious, but pious. Well, and his Ironsides that put the women and children of Drogheda to the sword with his Bible text, God is love, pasted round the mouth of the cannon. The English Protestants are pretending. The Bible. Then, don't forget the Catholics. Don't read the Bible so much. It is a Protestant thing. Did you read that skit piece in the United Irishman today about a Zulu chief visiting England? What's that? So the citizen takes up one of these paraphernalia papers and he starts reading out. And here we have read out by the citizen what looks like an interpolation, but is not. That is the kind of thing that the Irish papers, they made fun of whenever, and that is colonialism pure, whenever African kings, and of course they had kings, and the English had to be polite to them and receive them, but really made fun of them, reading out. So this is now something that is in the newspaper, but is not one of those interpolations, though it sounds like one. Good.
A delegation of the chief cotton magnates of Manchester was presented yesterday to His Majesty the Alakoi of Abeokuta by Goldstick-in-Waiting, Lord Walkup on Eggs, to tender to His Majesty the heartfelt thanks of British traders for the facilities afforded them in his dominions. The delegation partook of luncheon, at the conclusion of which the dusky potentate, in the course of a happy speech, freely translated by the British chaplain, the Reverend Ananias Praise God Barebones, tendered his best thanks to Massa Walkup and emphasised the cordial relations existing between Abeokuta and the British Empire, stating that he treasured as one of his dearest possessions an illuminated Bible, the volume of the Word of God, and the secret of England's greatness, graciously presented to him by the White Chief Woman, the Great Squaw Victoria, with a personal dedication from the august hand of the royal donor. The Alakoi then drank a loving cup of four-shot ishkaba to the toast, black and white, from the skull of his immediate predecessor in the dynasty Kakachakachak, surnamed 40 Watts, after which he visited the chief factory of Cottonopolis and signed his mark in the visitor's book, subsequently executing an old Abeokutic war dance, in the course of which he swallowed several knives and forks amid hilarious applause from the girl hands.
So, and that was a real, we have a picture of the Abeokutic, so that there were these things. A delegation of the chief cotton magnates of Manchester was presented yesterday to His Majesty the Alakoi of Abeokuta by Goldstick-in-Waiting, Lord Walkup on Eggs. And of course, they make fun. Oh yeah, here we have, as you can see it, we have the Abeokuta. And of course, they had their names, and they had to be very polite, exchange of words. To tender to His Majesty the heartfelt thanks of British traders for the facilities afforded them in his dominions. The delegation partook of luncheon, at the conclusion of which the dusky potentate, in the course of a happy speech, freely translated by the British chaplain, the Reverend Ananias Praise God Barebones, and I wish we had the translation. Ananias is a biblical name. Ananias is a famous biblical liar. Praise God, Barebones. So, tendered the best thanks to Master Walkup and emphasized the cordial relation existing between Abeokuta and the British Empire, stating that he treasured as one of his dearest possessions an illuminated Bible, the one of the Word of God, and the secret of England's greatness, graciously presented to him by the White Chief Woman, the Great Squaw Victoria. Squaw is, of course, a term from North America and not from Africa, with a personal dedication from the august hand of the royal donor. The Alakoi then drank a loving cup of first shot ushkabaw, that is whiskey, the water of life. The word whiskey is here. To the toast, black and white. That is quite nice, because obviously it's the white English and the black Africans, and there's a whiskey that's called black and white. From the skull of his immediate predecessor in the dynasty, named 40 Watts, after which he visited the chief factory of Cottonopolis, that must be Birmingham, and signed his mark in the visitor's book, subsequently executed an old Abeokuta war dance, in the course of which he swallowed several knives and forks amid hilarious applause from the girl, from girl hands. So you see a kind of thing which shows the colonial attitude, you know. You have to be polite to them, but you make really fun of them. So that is in a way, and a lot of that is colonialism at its best, as I just thought. So.
Widow woman, says Ned, I wouldn't doubt her. Wonder did he put that Bible to the same use as I would. Same, only more so, says Lenehan. And thereafter in that fruitful land, the broadleaf mango flourished exceedingly. Is that boy Griffith? Says John Wise. No, says the citizen. It's not signed Shangana. It's only initial P, and a very good initial too, says Joe. That's how it works, says the citizen. Trade follows the flag. Well, says JJ, if they're any worse than those Belgians in the Congo Free State, they must be bad. Did you read that report by a man? What's this his name is? Casement, says the citizen. He's an Irishman. Yes.
No, go on.
Go on.
Okay. Widow woman, says Anna. I know, widow. I wouldn't doubt her. Wonder did he put that Bible to the same use as I would. As you say, in Catholic countries, there's not the same respect for the Bible. The Protestants do that. Luther and all this. And then to Lennon, I wonder, did he put up the same use as I would? The Bible is paper. And in certain situations of your life, you need paper. So you see, like, same only more so. And thereafter in that fruitful land, the broadleaf mango flourished exceedingly. So you see the joke behind it, the use you would put that to. Is that by Griffith? Now, Griffith has turned up by early. Griffith was a new political leader who had new ideas how England could be fought. He heard it early in the fourth chapter. And he wrote, he had a paper himself, and he signed, and he often wrote, didn't sign it, or only with an initial. No, said the citizen, it's not signed Shanaganak. That seems to be in his pseudonym. And again, you remember the importance of names and wrong names and pseudonyms and things like that. It's only initial P. And a very good initial too, says Joe. That's how it's worked, says the citizen. Trade follows the flag. Well, says JJ, if they're any worse than those Belgians in the Congo Free State, they must be bad. Did you read that report by a man, or what's his name is? Casement, said a citizen. He's an Irishman. Yes, that's the man, says Jay, raping the women and girls and flogging the natives on the belly to squeeze the rubber that he can. And so he brings up a report, and that was very famous. Casement, Roger Casement, was an Irishman. Yeah, you see here, that's Sir Roger Casement, who was sent by to Congo, Belgian Congo, and he wrote a report just how cruel the Belgians were, and that was true, and the report was very famous. So the Belgians were also colonialists, of course, and if anything, even worse than the others, and so it isn't Casement that is raping the women, but it's the Belgian colonialists, the army, that are raping the women and flogging them to squeeze all the red rubber they can have. Congo, all that. And you know, Congo is not really much better off, if I'm correctly informed. Now, Casement, what's an important thing? Casement joined the Irish revolutionary troops that arranged the Easter Rising in 1916, when Joyce was in Zurich. There were Irish rebels who occupied the post office and proclaimed the Irish Republic. And they were later arrested and shot. And Casement wanted to join them, and he was arrested. And the British staged a famous trial in the court of which Casement was executed for treason. It was an old law that they used, and it became headlines, and Joyce must have heard of it when he was in Zurich. So the Casement is there. So, and now we come to something.
Yes, that's the man, says J.J., raping the women and girls and flogging the natives on the belly to squeeze all the red rubber they can out of them. I know where he's gone, says Lennon, cracking his fingers. Who? Says I. Bloom, says he. The courthouse is a blind. He had a few bob on throwaway and he's gone to gather in the shekels. Is it that white-eyed kaffir, says the citizen, that never backed a horse in anger in his life? That's where he's gone, says Lennon. I met Bantam Lyons going to back that horse, only I put him off it, and he told me Bloom gave him the tip. Bet you what you like, he has 100 shillings to five on. He's the only man in Dublin has it. A dark horse. He's a bloody dark horse himself, says Joe. Mind Joe, says I, show us the entrance out. There you are, says Terry.
Yeah. And now suddenly Lennon comes out and say, I know where he's gone. Bloom. And cracking his fingers. Who? Says I. Bloom, says he. The courthouse is a blind. Bloom says, I'm going to the courthouse around the corner, but is a blind, meaning it's a wrong lead. It's not true. It's a lie. He had a few four-bomb throwaway. Remember when Lennon came in? He had the news that throwaway, the outsider, had won the Gold Cup. And his bets were all wrong. He had a few bombs throwaway, and he's gone to gather in the shekels, the Jewish money. Is that the white-eyed kaffir, said the citizen, that never backed a horse in anger in his life? Bloom is known, in fact, you know, Bloom doesn't bet. He thinks it's a waste of money. And he never backed a horse. And isn't that nasty clever of him? The white-eyed kaffir, that was a music hall, seeing a white man who had a black patch over his eye. So it's another one-eyed musical act. And that was the white. Oh, yeah, you have it here. You can see it on the picture. Not very well. He was a white man dressed up as a black. And Kaffir, of course, is a nasty name for Africans that the Dutch gave him. That's where he's gone, says Lennon. I met Bantam Lyons going to back that horse. Only I put him off it, and he told me Bloom gave him the tip. Bet you what you like. He has 100 shillings five on. He's the only man in Dublin has it, a dark horse. Now, what makes Lennon think this? It's obviously not true. Bloom didn't care about betting, and he thinks it's a woman, and he hasn't. So why is it? And this is now the point where we can, but may not ultimately do, can reconstruct what happened. You may remember, of course, I always say you may remember, as one might, in the fifth chapter, Bloom came out of the chemist with the newspaper and the soap, and Bantam Lyons came to him and said, may I see the newspaper? What's the best news? I want to see about that French horse that's running. And Bloom, who wasn't very social, didn't want to talk about that, said, I'm truthful, I think. You can keep it. I was going to throw it away. And Bantam says, what? I was going to throw it away. And then he said, I risk it. What Bloom doesn't know, and we could not possibly know, is that among the horses for the Gold Cup, only four, one was the horse Throwaway that we just heard a week ago, that had won as an outsider. And it was Lenehan who, in the 10th chapter, looked into a betting office and found bantam lions trying to back the horse throwaway. And Lenehan, an expert who was given out a tip, you should bet on Scepter, dissuaded bantam lions from it. And Lenehan then thinks, wrongly, that Bloom really had some information and that Bloom was betting on that horse. And so he speculates that Bloom would have won and is now going to cash in on the money. As I said, tremendous odds of 20-1. So it's all based on a series of misunderstandings. Bloom has no idea. And we can now bring it together. But it also shows something about the chapter. At that moment in chapter 5, when Bantam Lion said, I'll risk it, and runs away. We don't know what happens. Bloom doesn't know. And I think it would be quite wrong to tell them what we can only find out right now, this particular passage. It's like giving away the murderer in the second chapter of a detective novel, that kind of thing. So that is now. So Bloom now is supposed of betting and knowing, and of course he's mean enough not to tell everybody. So that's the idea. A dark horse. He's a bloody dark horse himself, says Joe. And then there's a short other interlude that is quite unique and quite interesting.
Good boy, Ireland, I'm gone to court. So I just went round to the back of the yard to plump ship and be gob, 100 shillings to 5. While I was letting off me, throwaway 22, letting off me load, gob says I to myself, I knew he was uneasy in his 2 points off a Joe and one of Slattery's off. In his mind, they get off the mark to 100 shillings is 5 quid. And when they were in the dark horse, piss of work was telling me card party and letting on the child was sick. Gob, must have done about a gallon. Flabby arse of a wife speaking down the tube. She's better or she's... Oh, all a plan so we could vermouth with the pool if he won, or Jesus, full up I was. Trading without a license. Oil in my nation, says he. Never be up to those bloody. There's the last of it. Jerusalem. Cuckoos.
Good. So we have another instance of, you might say, toilet activities. You know, they're quite frequent and they're part of this particular book. Remember Bloom on the Jakes, that he had to go out in Davy Burns. And so here he's going to relieve himself. Show us the entrance out. Goodbye, I'm going to Gort. I don't know why the phrase Gort is there. It's a place in Ireland that has connections with Yates. I'm going to Gort. So I just went out to the back of the yard. That must have been something very primitive, maybe even outside. And you're to pump ship and be gob. And here now you have these parentheses when he is speaking to himself. 100 shillings to 5. Bloom, supposed to do that. While I was letting off my throwaway 22, letting off my load, gob, says I to myself. I knew he was easy in his 2 pints off of Joe and 1 in Slattery's off. So he counts how many pints he's had. He got 2 pints in this pub and 1 in Slattery. Now, 3 pints is quite a lot, and that explains that you might well have to be relieved. In his mind to get off the mark, 100 shillings is 5 quid. And when they were in the dark horse, piss a buck, the one who knew the Blooms in the City Arms Hotel, was telling me card party and letting on the child was sick. Gob must have done about a gallon. Flabby arse of a wife speaking down the tube. Obviously, they had the tube there and you could speak down. She's better, you know. Obviously, suspicion is they were cheating by something or two. All around, so he could vamoose with the pool if you want. Vamoose is disappear. Jesus, four by one. Trading without the license. Ow! Isle of my nation, says he. Boom. Oi, stop. Never be up to this bloody, the last of it, Jerusalem or Cuckoos. I don't quite know what the different Cuckoo is, but obviously it's not a champion. So here you have an interesting and I think quite unique paragraph of what happens in the mind when you are letting water.
So anyhow, when I got back, they were at it ding dong. John Moy saying it was Bloom gave the idea for Sinn Féin to Griffith to put in his paper all kinds of gerrymandering, pack juries and swindle the taxes off of the government and appointing councils all over the world to walk about selling Irish industries, robbing Peter to pay Paul. God, that puts the bloody kibosh on it. If old sloppy eyes is mucking up the show, give us a bloody chance. God save Ireland from the likes of that bloody mouseabout. Mr. Bloom with his argold bargold and his elfella before him, perpetuating frauds. All Methuselah Bloom, the robbing bagman, that poisoned himself with the prussic acid after he swamped the country with his baubles and his penny diamonds, loans by post on easy terms, any amount of money advanced on note of hand. Distance, no object, no security. Gobbies like Lanty McHale's goat that'll go a piece of the road with everyone. Well, it's a fact, says John Moyes. And there's the man now that'll tell you about it. Martin Cunningham.
So, anyhow, when I got back, they were at it ding-dong. Obviously, I missed something. John Wise saying it was Bloom gave the idea for Sinn Féin to through Griffith. And now here there's a rumour, an accusation, that Bloom was a man who inspired Griffin, the new political man. The fact is, Griffith found out that the Hungarians, under Austrian rule, they were as unhappy as the Irish were on the British rule, but the Hungarians had brought about something. They had brought about a measure of independence, that they could do their own local business. And that's something Griffith said the Irish should also do, not the revolution, but just have your own councils and your own system and things like that and all of this. And why do they think Bloom is? Because we know in this chapter, Bloom is of Hungarian origin. And since Griffith had that, and he wrote the pamphlet, maybe you see it, the Hungarian system, that Ireland should imitate that kind of autonomy. So you could easily rumor, think that Bloom, a Hungarian Jew, might be behind it. I'm quite sure there's nothing behind it, but it's interesting. Bloom as a somebody behind the scenes doing all this, which would make Bloom actually a nationalist, and they should appreciate it. But this is probably most likely one of these rumors. So the Sinn Féin is a movement. For ourselves, Ireland to the Irish, and you realize it is also a nationalist thing against foreigners coming. Sinn Féin, as you know, is now still the party in Ireland, and I even think they're part of the government. To put in his paper all kinds of gerrymandering, gerrymandering is to distribute the election proportions so that other results come out. Packed juries is juries where the jury is free informed. And swindling the taxes off of the government and pounding concerts all over the world to walk about selling industries. This is more or less what Griffith said, imitating the Hungarian system. Robbing Peter to pay Paul, that's the same. Corp. That puts the bloody kibosh on it if old Sloppy Eyes is mucking up the show. So even that would not be in Bloom's favour, is mucking up the show. Give us a bloody chance. God Save Ireland, which is also a song, from the likes of the bloody mouseabout. Mr. Bloom with his argle-bargle. Argle-bargle means argumentation and talk and things like that. And his old fellow, now we have something of Bloom's father, before him, perpetuating frauds. Old Methuselah Bloom, who obviously lived long, the Robbie Bagman, probably hawking around the streets with the bag, that poisoned himself. So they know about Bloom's father committing suicide with a prussic acid. That isn't quite accurate. From what we know, it's aconite, but obviously you can easily be mistaken about it. After he's swamping the country with his baubles, he was obviously a hawker selling things, brushes and things like that, and his penny diamonds. And that's probably what he had. Loans by post on easy terms. Any amount of money advanced on note of hand. Distance, no object, no security. Gov is like Lanty McHale's goat that go a piece of the road with everyone. So, Bloom. So, that rumour doesn't change what they think of him. Well, it's a fact, said John Wise. I must have said, when there's so much that isn't accurate or is made up or is only speculation, the word fact is interesting. And I think the word fact is always funny when somebody says, that's a fact. Mm-hmm. Somebody even created the phrase, an Irish fact. That is, whatever they decide to tell you, for whatever good reason. And as I found out, this is a prejudice, don't go with me. The Irish are very nice, and they often tell you a nice story that you like, rather than tell you something that is uncomfortable or disappointing. And the value of a story is its entertainment value, and not its relation to truth. I hope there's no objection from the Irish in the audience, there's something like that. And there's a man now that will tell you about it, Martin Cunningham. And now we have another interpolation, and what we do now is we read the interpolation, but I talk about it only next time, because it's time and my voice is again going. So we still listen to that. It's another parody of a new party arriving, like a historical novel.
Sure enough, the castle car drove up with Martin on it and Jack Pearl with them, and a fellow named Crofton, pensioner out of the Collector Generals, an Ordnance man, blackboned his have on the registration, and he'd drawn his pay, or Crawford, gallivanting around the country at the king's expense. Our travellers reached the rustic hostelry and alighted from their palfreys. "Ho, varlet," cried he, who by his mien seemed the leader of the party. "Saucy knave, to us!" So saying, he knocked loudly with his sword hilt upon the open lattice. Mine host came forth at the summons, girding him with his tabard. "Give you good den, my masters," said he, with an obsequious bow. "Bestir thyself, sirrah," cried he who had knocked. "Look to our steeds. And for ourselves, give us of your best, for if faith, we need it." "Lack-a-day, good masters," said the host. "My poor house has but a bare larder. I know not what to offer your lordships." "How now, fellow," cried the second of the party, a man of pleasant countenance, So servest thou the king's messengers, Master Tapton? An instantaneous change overspread the landlord's visage. Cry you mercy, gentlemen, he said humbly. And you be the king's messengers, God shield his majesty. You shall not want for aught. The king's friends, God bless his majesty, shall not go a-fasting in my house, I warrant me. Then about, cried the traveller who had not spoken, a lusty trencherman by his aspect, has aught to give us? Mine host bowed again as he made answer. What say you, good masters, to a squab pigeon pasty, some collops of venison, a saddle of veal, widgeon with crisp hog's bacon, a boar's head with pistachios, a basin of jolly custard, a medlar tansy, and a flagon of old Rhenish? Gadzooks, cried the last speaker, that likes me well. Pistachios. Aha, cried he of the pleasant countenance, a poor house and a bare larder, quoth I. Tis a merry rogue.
So this is the interpolation, like the arrival of somebody in a historical novel. Just before that, I did, well, it's a fact, said John Wise. And there's a man returned, Martin Cunningham. And then, sure enough, the castle car drove up. Martin Cunningham, we saw that, has the use of the castle car. So basically, he's the English establishment. And Jack Power is him. And a fellow named Croft or Crofton, pensioner of the collector's guild. An orange, black, don't have other station. And he drawing his face, or Crawford, they don't know how his name is, gallivanting round the counter to King's expense. And the talk, and I go through it next time, is they're coming. First the host says, we have nothing to eat. And then they know it's from the king, the doubling, the castle car, and then it changes. Of course, there's nothing to eat in our pub here. The biscuits are all gone and things like that. So this is a historical interpolation, and I think we come to it next time. You realize we're coming slowly to a sort of climax, and it will take about two more sittings to finish the chapter. As I said, one of the most lively ones. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye. Thank you.